something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast.
Binge close to 100 episodes. Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chat with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming back to the show, if you're coming back.
Yeah, if you're here for the first time, then, I don't know, better? Well, even better?
We'll be gentle.
I don't know. I love our return listeners.
I know. It's nice.
Here's the thing. That's, you know what? No, yeah. We send a little bit more love to our return listeners.
That's
right. Incentive to come back a second time.
Right.
New listeners, welcome. We love you. Returning listeners,
God damn.
Damn.
You look good.
Yeah, y'all look great.
You look good today.
Woof. Is it hot in here, or is it?
It is hot in here.
So glad you're here.
Uh-huh.
I'm Eli.
I'm Diana.
I have a text message. Let's read it on the air.
Oh, I know what it is. It's old news is what it is.
That is old news. We're very glad that Bob Odenkirk is okay.
You guys, we were worried all day.
We're recording this. Yeah.
Mr. Show fans, we were very worried about Bob Odenkirk. And his other work. But
sure.
Mainly because of Mr. Show.
Well, because we have a sketch comedy background, and Mr. Show is foundational.
Huge inspiration.
Any sketch comedy post the early 90s.
We met Tom Kenny at Dragon Con once, and everybody was there to talk about SpongeBob, except for us and this other couple in line who were there specifically to talk about Mr. Show, and we had such a good time waiting with them to see him.
And he was so glad because everybody wanted to talk about SpongeBob, and I think we blew his mind a little bringing up Mr. Show.
Mr. Show!
Yeah. Anyway, we're glad Mr. Bob Odenkirk is okay.
Yes.
At least as of this recording.
So far.
He's in recovery. Mm-hmm. Well, like we said, we're so excited to be here. We're so excited you are here.
Yeah.
And we want to share some of our excitement with you today because we've got ourselves a mail call.
Mail!
Awesome.
We got an email from Robert Smith.
Robert Smith? From The Cure? So glad he listens.
It could be. It could be him. He says, "Hi, Eli and Diana. I came across your podcast by pure chance, and I am so glad I did. I love listening to them on my walks in rural Scotland. I am a teacher at Scotland's oldest school, founded in 1183, where they teach classical studies. I have sent the episodes about Elagabalus to my colleague, but told her to maybe not tell the kids about her love of large you-know-whats.
Uh-oh.
Keep up the amazing work from Robert Smith in Bonnie, Scotland. P.S. I'm happy for my name to be read out, but Robert Smith sounds like a fake name.
All right,
so I guess
fair
it's
enough,
not,
Robert.
It's not the cure.
It's Robert not the Smith. Cure, Robert Smith, but that's okay. You're probably more fun to hang out with.
Undoubtedly. That's so cool that he works at the oldest school in Scotland.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Right?
Also, Robert, I have a Scottish background myself. My grandmother was an immigrant from Scotland.
Uh-huh.
So I feel that I have every right to come visit you.
Absolutely.
And crash on your couch.
Yeah.
So hopefully
that's how it works, right?
You don't mind when I show up.
We're just going to go knocking on school doors in Scotland and say, are you the oldest?
Right?
Are you the oldest school? Sorry. This school was built in 1987.
Oh, I love it.
Get on down to the other Bonnie Wee School. That's I assume that they say.
Bonnie Wee School?
Bonnie Wee School. That's awesome. Thank you for writing in, Robert.
Yeah, so cool to hear from you, Robert. Thank you so much.
I have to bring us back down after all that excitement.
No.
Because, unfortunately, I hate this.
Oh.
We have to go back to Corrections Corner.
What?
You're such a loser.
This is a self-correction. This is something that I uncovered that we did horribly wrong. This is an egregious mistake that I am fuming about to this day. I discovered it yesterday, and all night it's kept me up. I am livid. And it's not so much something we got wrong as it is something that we entirely omitted.
Damn.
Our recent episode, we talked about King Soretse and Ruth Williams and their story about their interracial love, which kind of shocked Southern Africa and England, and eventually led to a redrawing of the map of Africa and the founding of the country that is now Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
Very exciting story. Well, Soretse Khama spent some time in England, and he went to school at Oxford. And never once in this episode, in that particular moment, nor in the entire rest of the show, did we ever once make the joke Oxford Khama. Come on. I can't believe
that
information passed us by, and never once did I say, oh, he was a real Oxford comma or something. Like,
yeah, we should have said when they were making fun of him for being an African king, we should have been like, they should have been making fun of him for being an Oxford comma.
God damn it. So upset.
Cancel the podcast.
It's embarrassing, quite frankly. I didn't even want to put this in the corrections corner because it's so embarrassing.
Damn.
That we let that slip by, but I had to own it.
Well,
I had to bring it up.
I'm proud of you.
Oxford comma. It's so good. His name is comma, and he went to Oxford. Like, how much? You don't get a layup that often.
It's just, you know? So true.
And
we
I just let that ball just
food.
Soar right past me and flop on the ground. It's outrageous. So I apologize to all of our listeners.
Me too. I should have caught that as well.
Yeah.
I do apologize.
I mean, it's going to take some time.
You should expect more from us.
Yeah. You really should. But we will try not to let you down again.
Yeah.
I hope we can all move past it because we've got an exciting episode to get to today. So
we do.
Please, if we can, all just put this behind us. Let's talk about Murasaki.
Yeah. Today's episode is about Murasaki Shikibu and the Tale of Genji. And it's a sort of a departure for us, I guess.
Yeah,
not really.
Say so.
Still in the romance genre,
right,
for sure.
Right.
Because Murasaki Shikibu wrote one of the oldest novels ever written called The Tale of Genji. And the story was all about romance and the woes of human existence. And though Murasaki seems to not have experienced much romance in her own life, today she's a symbol for marital success in Japan.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to kind of explore how that went down.
Yeah, it's very cool. Not your traditional, one person loves another story, but rather about the concept of romance itself, and it's
mm-hmm.
And some symbols of that in ancient Japan, which we're excited to get into.
Ancient Japan's cool. Japanese history is so interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to be on this archipelago.
That's awesome. Here comes the music, and let's go.
Yay!
Hey there, friends, come listen well. Eli and Diana got some stories to tell. There's no matchmaking or romantic tips. It's just about ridiculous relationships. A lover might be any type of person at all. An abstract concept or a concrete wall. But if there's a story worth a second glance, we'll put it in our show, Ridiculous Romance.
A production of iHeartRadio.
So, yeah, let's talk about Murasaki Shikibu. Murasaki was a Japanese novelist and a poet. She was a lady-in-waiting in the imperial court during the Heian period, which is considered the height of classical Japanese culture.
The Heian period, as Tony Danza would say. For all you who's the boss fans out there.
I know. What
Heian.
What a today reference that you've made. She was born probably 973 or 978 to the powerful Fujiwara family, who basically ran all of Japan for generations through strategic marriages of their daughters to emperors and emperors' sons, and through the use of regencies. So what they did was basically they would be the regent. The emperor was just kind of there to like wave at people and be at like religious ceremonies. Like he was really a figurehead. The real power was behind the throne.
Right.
With this regent. And the Fujiwaras were like, well, we always going to be the regent. Mm-hmm. One of us is always going to be that guy.
Smart.
Murasaki's branch of the family had lost some status over the generations. They were not at the level of the regent Fujiwaras, but rather at the level of provincial governors. But they had some extra clout in her branch because of their literary prowess. Both her grandfather and great-grandfather were well-known poets. Her real name is unknown. Her diary entries from 1007 include the names of several of the ladies-in-waiting that she lived at court with, including the name Fujiwara no Takako, and that might be her actual name, some scholars believe. But everyone knows her as Murasaki Shikibu.
So during the Heian period, it was considered too blunt to say people's actual names. That your name was your own.
It's like rude.
Right. So women would take their names based on their own designation in court or by the rank or job of their father. So Shikibu refers to the Ministry of Ceremonials, where her father was a functionary. And Murasaki refers to a shade of purple that comes from a wisteria plant. And wisteria is the meaning of Fuji. This also makes her novel really hard to translate, because the characters in the novel would often be described by their clothes, basically. So, like, if a character changes clothes, as they often did, suddenly they had a whole new name and you had to go figure out if they were a new character or an old one through context clues. It's like, oh, Mrs. Yellow just passed through the room. I wonder what she's doing today. And then, oh, Lady Blue Shoes just came back by. Did the same woman come through and come back? Or were those two different people? Did she change?
Yeah. And so, yeah, I guess some translators have been like, this makes it a little bit hard to figure out. Let's keep the thread of everything going on.
I mean, imagine trying to read Wuthering Heights, and the characters are only called by the color of their coats.
Right.
And they change their coats
every
10 minutes.
Lace collar came in.
Yeah.
You know, it's like everyone has one of those.
I assume readers of the time were way more adept at keeping up with this than I would be now reading it.
Honestly, I think they were.
Yeah.
I think they kind of knew a little bit who they were talking about.
Right.
In Japan at the time, also, only men learned Chinese. Chinese was the language of the government, and so it was only for men to know. Women weren't meant to know this language. They were only meant to speak and write in Japanese. And at this time, Japan was becoming a little more isolated. They had used to send a bunch of emissaries on trips to China to learn, like, study their art and their politics and their government structures, which they would then bring back that knowledge and use it to create structures in Japan. But now it's the 9th and 10th centuries. They have revolutionized everything by creating kana, which is the alphabet for Japanese, basically, for the Japanese language that they're already speaking, but now they could actually write it down.
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to assert their own culture and their own traditions and everything instead of just trying to modify Chinese stuff, basically. Mm. But Murasaki knew Chinese. She wrote in her diary that she learned Chinese by listening at the door when her father taught her brother in preparation for his government career. She wrote, "I became unusually proficient at understanding those passages that he found too difficult to understand and memorize. Father, a most learned man, was always regretting the fact. Just my luck, he would say. What a pity she was not born a man."
Outrageous. Come on.
I think that's funny because it comes up so much when women do something out of the ordinary and her father's always like, if only you were a man or whatever. And I'm like, did it never occur to you you should like organize society differently? I guess not.
There I was like, oh, I had 5 daughters and all of them are so much smarter than the average man. It's, you know, what a strange coincidence that these 5 girls are a lot smarter than I assume women to be. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it must be 5 freak accidents.
Right? And it's especially funny because they thought women didn't have the intelligence to grasp the Chinese language.
Right.
And meanwhile, she's learning outside the door from like whatever she can hear. And she's doing better than her brother, who's getting the full attention of his teacher. Come on.
A, I do not have the intelligence to learn the Chinese language.
Same.
It's too... I mean, I probably do, but I should have started a long ass time ago. The few times I've looked at it, I'm like, nope, can't. I am too dumb. And second of all, I can't hear you through the bathroom door, like when you're trying to tell me something I need to know. Like I couldn't learn Chinese from you through that door. That's for damn sure. Especially if you weren't even talking to me. That is impressive.
I'm impressed by this.
So usually husbands and wives kept separate households during the Heian period. The children would live with the mother, but Murasaki lived with her father. Now, it's likely because her mother probably died in childbirth. Mm-hmm. And it was also unusual for noble women to travel distances further than a few days. But she accompanied her father when he had a 4-year governorship post in the Echizen province. Also, unusually for noble women, she didn't get married as soon as she hit puberty. She stayed in her father's household until her mid-20s. Or possibly even her early 30s. What an old lady.
Whoa, she's practically dead.
You need a walker there, Grandma?
What, is your womb all dried up at this point?
Right. Oh, you're 30? Well, you're 18 years behind marriage.
I mean, like, come on. Outrageous. And you know what? She's still perfectly fine, everyone.
I know, right? Sharp as a tack. So anyway, her education and her lifestyle had already set her apart.
Probably made her a better writer, don't you think?
Yeah.
She had a little more experience of the world and...
Yeah. And she wasn't married at 12, so...
Well, right?
A lot more to say.
A lot more to say.
I don't know. So many of these older cultures, I mean, even some current cultures, you know, marriage at puberty is... not uncommon. And of course, it's outrageous to us. Mm-hmm. Actually, you can go listen to some of that in our recent guest appearance
on
Ridiculous History. If you guys didn't catch that, we guested on Ben and Noel's show and talked about some fascinating courting rituals from around the world. It's a two-parter. And some of those have to do with just how young people sometimes are when they start getting entwined with a partner.
So true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good time.
Yeah. Anyway, she came back to the capital, Kyoto, which at the time was called Heian-kyo, to marry her father's friend, Fujiwara no Nobutaka. And he was a much older second cousin of hers. Probably this was like around the year 998 or 999.
Nobutaka is a bureaucrat like her father. He's known as a talented dancer and an extravagant dresser. He's gregarious and well-known at court. He's probably in his late 40s when they married. And he had several other households. He had wives. He had other children. He had numerous romantic affairs going on in the court and stuff. Which I was like, who's got the time?
Seriously.
Like, my God. You got to visit every one of these bitches. Like, how do you not have other shit to do?
Oh, my God. Hang on. Tuesday through Thursday, it's out for me because I've got 9 wives to visit and I got to give them 3 hours each.
Yeah, otherwise they get mad.
Uh-huh.
And then I don't know my kids' names yet, so I better right, go cram before I go see them. But apparently courtiers at this time had very few actual duties, so they had all kinds of time to have affairs and do crazy stuff. So I guess he did have the time. Much more than we do today.
Yeah, right. So, all right. His job is literally not to do that much.
Yeah.
Just to marry a lot.
You're just meant to be here and look cool, yeah. I guess, and like write poetry and be cool.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Be a dancer, mm-hmm. dress flamboyantly.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, that's it.
And is this, is there an application process here or is somewhere I can get, I would do like an apprenticeship for this.
I think you had to be a Fujiwara dude. I don't think you got to.
Is that a possibility?
I think it'd be tough for you, yes, to be a Fujiwara descendant, but it's not impossible. You should do your 23andMe and
listen
find
to
out. Me.
I'm a white man, and I like to be able to do whatever I want, and I want to be a Fujiwara.
Take it up with Japan.
I will not.
Yeah, I actually wish you wouldn't.
No, I will definitely
they
not.
They have other things to do.
Discuss that with
They're
Japan.
In the middle of the Olympics, fact, and they got other shit
yeah.
to do.
Japan, I apologize for distracting you at this difficult time. Please ignore me.
They're like, we were. Yeah. Don't worry.
Like, huh? What? Anyway.
So Murasaki would have stayed at her dad's house, and her husband would come to visit her there. So that was like her living arrangement, kind of. And accounts kind of vary about how happy this marriage was. The professor of Japanese studies at Cambridge, Richard Bowring, says their marriage was happy in his book. But Japanese literature scholar Haruo Shinane thinks that there were indications in Murasaki's poetry that she resented her husband.
Yeah.
So we don't know if she liked him or not.
So she probably has a poem that's like, no, everything's fine. And Richard Browning's like, well, she said everything's fine.
The poem's called Let's Do Whatever You Want to Do.
Shinane's like, yeah, there was problems here. She was not happy.
Yeah, Shinane's like, I've written that fucking poem before. I'll tell you what.
Richard's like, she said everything's fine. I don't understand. Let's do whatever you want to do. That's very nice. What a gesture.
Yeah, Mrs. Bowring's like, mm-hmm. There was probably a poem called Mm-hmm.
Oh, jeez. So Murasaki and Nobutaka had a daughter in the year 999, and her name was Kenshi. And then Nobutaka died 2 years later during a cholera epidemic. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't married for very long. She's got a daughter now. Once she was married, now she's going to get servants to take care of her for day-to-day stuff. Then that gave her a lot of leisure time. It's likely that she started writing the novel that she's known for, The Tale of Genji, during her marriage and then finished it while at court. Mm-hmm. So she suddenly got all the time in the world.
Right.
Everybody's taking care of business for her. Sounds great.
Man, seriously.
If I had, servants and ladies in waiting taking care of my day-to-day stuff, I'd finally write a book, too.
I know, right?
I mean, it would help. Let's be honest. No, I wouldn't. But at least I would finally not have anything else to blame. So let's talk about The Tale of Genji and get into that story a little bit right after this little commercial break.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star starting May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...with zero qualifications...
She had a Harvard plaque.
...tricks her way past a wall of lawyers and agents.
She's got all of these Maseratis and Bentleys all in the driveway.
Is it like a mansion?
Yes, it's a mansion. ...that this queen of the con uses to scam some of the biggest names in professional sports out of untold fortunes.
About $6 million.
Approximately $11 million.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
Employing whatever means necessary to bleed her victims dry.
She would probably have sex with one of her clients.
Hide your money in your old rich man because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody. We're about to dive into the Tale of Genji.
Tales differ about how the Tale of Genji was inspired. In one legend, an empress asked for a new story, and she and Murasaki retreated to a temple to get some peace and quiet to write. There was a full moon, and she stared at it, lost in its beauty, and a vision of the tale rose before her. Royal Tyler, who translated Genji in 2008, wrote in Harvard Magazine, quote, "She saw her hero, Genji, languishing in unjust exile on the shore of a moonlit sea, and the image was so compelling that she immediately wrote down what would become chapters 11 and 12. Legend has it that since childhood she was close with a gifted courtier who had been unjustly banished, and she drew on his story for inspiration as well. Even though many Japanese scholars have dismissed this idea, it's very common for paintings or etchings of Murasaki to depict her at the Ishiyama Temple looking up at the moon. It's a very classic image in Japan.
Mm, yeah.
Murasaki looking at the moon.
And the Tale of Genji is a really important literary achievement. It's considered by some to be the world's first novel, period.
Like before Sorcerer's Stone.
That, long before Sorcerer's Stone.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone came out 32,000 years ago. I don't know if anybody knew that, but...
Well, I think it's older than that.
Before that. Wow, okay. Before the Da Vinci Code.
Other people do qualify it a little bit by saying it's maybe not the world's first novel, but it's the world's first psychological novel, where the inner lives and thoughts and feelings of the characters are more the focus of the writing than like the events of the plot.
Okay, yeah.
Some other people say it's the oldest novel that's still considered a classic today. You know, there's a lot of qualifiers.
Yeah.
It is widely considered to be one of the oldest novels, right, like of that genre of fiction.
Of prose. You know, not like Gilgamesh. Beowulf. Yeah, those, you know, the epic poems and everything, but
prose.
Solid prose novel.
She wrote it concertina style, which I thought was cool. It's where the pages were pasted together and they folded in on each other like a fan.
So accordion style.
Yeah, but it's a concertina because it's slightly smaller.
Yeah, but it's...
than an accordion.
But if I'm opening it, it's like an accordion.
Yeah, it makes that noise.
But if you cut it into shapes like and then unfolded it would be like the chain of gingerbread men.
I guess. You'd be cutting a piece of literature, sir.
Gonna. That's outrageous. I would never do it. I found this 1,100-year-old scroll. Let me see if I can cut it into snowflakes and hang them up.
That would be
Christmas.
So fucked. Somebody's tried it. That's all I'm saying. And she probably wrote it in installments and then passed on new chapters to ladies-in-waiting and to other people so they would get copied and shared. And that's kind of how her notoriety was getting around.
That's the best. We should be releasing things in chapters, not dumped all at once onto Netflix. Come on, guys. Week-to-week episodes. It's much more engaging.
I mean, people do have time to talk about it. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And she had time to finish it, let's be honest.
Well,
she had to wait till the end. It would be a George R.R. Martin situation.
Right.
Where you would just be like, waiting for a new story for like 20 years.
I've been on chapter 36 for the last two dynasties.
The book ends up having 54 chapters, and translated into English, it's around 1,100 pages long. There are tons of side characters. There's not really a central plot. I mean, Genji's your main protagonist, obviously. But mainly all the characters are, you're following them as they age. So they're just kind of dealing with life as it comes along and thinking about their scheme, their place in the scheme of things.
Right.
And it also focuses mainly on Genji's romantic life. So she describes a lot about what aristocratic life was like at the time. He has a bunch of sexy times.
Oh, go get it, Genji.
There's a New York Times article titled, "After 1,000 Years, Kyoto Still Loves Genji and Its Author." And they describe the plot as, "The married hero impregnates his stepmother, falls in love with a child whom he raises to be his wife." Side note, that character is named Murasaki after the author, which is an interesting choice.
The daughter that he marries.
Yes.
No, which is not his own daughter.
No.
Right.
Yeah, he adopted her.
Yeah.
And she was cute. And then she grew up, and he's like, now we'll get married.
Woody Allen.
It's like a weird grooming thing.
Did a Woody Allen thing. Okay.
Did a Woody Allen thing.
All right.
Genji retreats into exile after he's discovered in mid-tryst with the daughter of a political enemy. Supporting characters fall victim to amnesia and die of heartbreak. They exchange poems and dampen brocade sleeves with bitter tears.
Wow. Evocative. Right.
Yeah, this article says that, quote, to modern readers, the book's enormous emotive cast can seem overwrought.
Sure.
But it kind of just sounds like a soap opera to me.
Right.
I mean, like, fully, like, amnesia, heartbreak.
Right.
Marrying your stepmother.
Uh-huh.
Like, I feel like those are all plot lines.
One character
you could find.
Is in a terrible accident and she has to change her clothes and she comes back as a new actress.
And everyone's like, oh my gosh, it's yellow dress.
Yeah, it's a yellow dress. I thought, you look so much better than when you wore blue shoes.
Yeah, okay. She even distributed it in episodes. So it was very much like
a
telenovela kind
of. Absolutely.
So I was kind of picturing it like a Days of Our Lives meets Mrs. Dalloway, where you're like getting these like really deep inner thoughts of these like soap opera characters.
Right. So Genji may be partially based on the most powerful figure in court politics at the time. His name was Fujiwara no Mishinaga. He was the regent when the power of the Fujiwara clan would reach its zenith. How did he get this power? Well, the classic Fujiwara way. Strategically marrying off his daughters. I'm going to marry off my daughters strategically, like my father before him with all my sisters and his father before him with all my aunts.
Exactly.
That's what you got to do. So Mishinaga is cunning, right? This guy knows what to do. And he's got a nephew named Korochika. Korochika was supposed to be regent because his sister, Teishi, was the empress. But Michinaga was like, I got other plans. I want to be regent. So he led his nephew to believe that the former emperor, named Emperor Kazan, was sleeping with Korachika's mistress. So Korachika and his servants jumped on Kazan and struck him with an arrow. And this is outrageous because, of course, not only was he the former emperor, but he actually abdicated his throne to become a monk. So you're like attacking a former emperor slash monk, serious crime. And Michinaga, his uncle who put him up to this, was like, oh no, that's very bad. How dare you? And he pressed charges of lèse majesté laws, which is where you can't do bad things against a ruler. Mm-hmm. And the court found Korachika guilty of putting a curse on the current emperor's mother, Senshi. And she already didn't like Korachika, and she was helping Michinaga take over. So this was all arranged by Michinaga to, like, fuck up his nephew.
She didn't have no curse.
Uh-huh. Surprise, there wasn't a curse.
Well.
So pretty cunning dude there. Mm-hmm. He's screwing everybody else over to get himself into power. Poor Emperor Kazan is just walking down the street one day like, doo-doo-doo, I'm not an emperor anymore. I'm a monk. At least nobody's going to try and assassinate me. Gets attacked.
Well, it was pretty funny that he's a monk, but they're like, oh, he's sleeping with your mistress. Right. Like, aren't they not supposed to sleep with me?
I
know they do.
To.
But I guess, yeah. Apparently he just entered the building and it was like the same building the mistress was in. And so it was like enough for Korachika.
Wow.
So maybe he wouldn't have been a good regent.
He
might have been like, if you jump to conclusions that quickly and you're so quick to be like, we got to jump him and
Korachika
show him what's up.
Very gullible.
Yeah, maybe you're not. Maybe Michinaga was like, oh, we can't let this guy take over.
That's his real crime is that I set him up for this and he was dumb enough to believe it.
I know. He's like,
they're like, yeah, you should definitely take control. So Michinaga himself married a couple of sisters, like you do, and of powerful warrior clans, so that he'd get himself some muscle. He's like, I married all these sisters and they all got tough brothers.
So. Right. And their loyalty's to me now because I'm married to their sister.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So he wasn't just strategically marrying off his daughters. He also strategically married off himself.
Yeah.
And he of all the Fujiwaras, managed to marry off the most of his daughters to emperors. He married four of his daughters to emperors. So
is that
he had
in the Guinness records?
I know, right? Where's that? So he had unprecedented power.
Way to go, Michinaga. You really gamed the system there.
Right. And you might be wondering how he was managed to marry his daughters to a bunch of emperors. Well, first of all, they didn't all get married at the same time. Some of them married the emperor's sons, so it was kind of like hedging your bets. Like, you'd be like, I don't know which son's going to take over, but I'll have a daughter in every household, so then just in case I get to have some power in the situation. But one way that he managed to marry his daughters to so many emperors is that he just didn't care if the emperor was already married.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So the emperor Ichijo already had an empress. Her name's Teishi. We already met her. Remember, it was her brother, Korachika, who was supposed to become regent.
Right.
But Teishi had supported her brother, obviously, during this whole power struggle with Michinaga.
Oh, no.
So when he lost, she also lost. She lost a lot of popularity and a lot of support at court. So she's still empress, but people just aren't very respectful, I guess.
She's like, a curse is insane. Why do people believe this? And they're all like, oh.
So Michinaga wanted to undermine her even more, and by doing so, also strengthen his own position. Let's not forget. That's always the main thing.
Yep.
So he had his daughter Shoshi become part of Ichijo's harem when she was about 12 years old. And a year later, he had her named Empress, even though Teishi was already named Empress. He was just like, whatever. I do what I want.
Wow.
Historian and professor emeritus of East Asian languages at Berkeley, Donald Shively, says Michinaga shocked even his admirers by doing this. This would be the first time in Japanese history that an emperor had two empress consorts at the same time.
I love that they are putting the blame on that to Michinaga and not the emperor who married.
Oh,
they
all knew who was in charge. I love the idea, though, that Ichijo didn't have any choice.
Who am I marrying today?
Here's a 13-year-old girl in your harem. Have you met her yet?
No.
Well, anyway, she's going to be your new empress.
Oh, okay. Don't I already have a
wife?
Yeah.
Don't worry about her.
Okay, I guess
we'll deal with that.
He had Taishi named Lustrous Airbearer because she had a son. And Shoshi was named Inner Palatine, which I guess unofficially was somehow a higher title than Taishi's.
Damn.
So I was like, poor Taishi. She's like, so wait a minute. Not only does this bitch have the same title as me, it's somehow higher than mine? And I got here first? This is bullshit. Who do I talk to?
So Mishinaga invited Murasaki to make up part of the new Empress Shoshi's court. Could have been a number of reasons for this, apparently. See, Murasaki exchanged poetry with Mishinaga, and that has led some scholars to think maybe they had a little something going on.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like much, just a little, oh, here you go, some poems for you, sir.
Oh, thank you.
You know, it seems like a pretty standard procedure to us, but aristocratic women of that time lived very restrictive lives. So Murasaki wouldn't have been allowed to speak to men unless they were very close relatives or members of the household. She socialized with women, and she often exchanged poetry with women, but she had very limited contact with men other than her father and her brother, and she never exchanged poetry with men. So this is a total departure from the norm, and very interesting that she slipped Mishinaga a couple of poems, you know, like, hey, I got a couple of stanzas for you, buddy. What do you think of these? Here's a rhyming couplet for you, handsome.
Hi. But I don't know if she was really into him or if he was just into her.
Right.
Because she also wrote about his pursuit of her in her diary as late as 1010, saying that she had to avoid advances from him. Like one night he sneaked into her room and stole a newly written chapter of Genji.
Unbelievably rude.
But in one poem she gave him, she wrote, "You have neither read my book nor won my love."
Wow.
Which, take note, if you want to love an artist, you gotta engage with whatever art they make.
Yeah.
Okay? You can't be like, I love this author, but I'll never read her book. You're gonna have to read the book, man.
Get that content. Yeah, I would say by like the fifth date, you gotta have a good grasp of their art.
Yeah, man. They will take it personally.
That's why, you know, maybe you don't date a 1,000-page novelist. You're looking at a lot of work.
It's a lot of reading. Well, she does it by chapter, so you got time.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Catch up.
Yeah, catch up.
He's like, yes, dear. I'm working my way up to chapter 683, but I'm only on 22 so far, so.
Call me when you finish it, Click.
He's like, all right, and he accordions it back up.
But his patronage was essential if she wanted to keep writing because he was providing her with the expensive paper and ink and court calligraphers to make copies. So I'm like, she might have just been giving him poems because she's like, you're paying for this. So
yeah.
Here, read it.
Here's what your money's buying.
Or she's like, I guess I'll let you touch my boobs if it means I can write my story. I don't know.
Yeah, we've all been there. I forget sometimes the expenses that would go into this.
Mm-hmm.
Paper and ink were not, you know, you couldn't just go down to the old Office Depot.
Nope.
And pick up a ream.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I don't think of is like how thirsty people would be for a chapter of something or a poem or whatever, because you didn't have Netflix, you know? You didn't even have a Blockbuster.
Yeah.
This was well before either of those things by a couple years. And
just a few.
And
so
it's like,
old.
Oh my God, a piece of fiction?
Mm-hmm.
For the love of God, I've been waiting years to read one of these, literally, you know?
Well, just like the legend was that she wrote The Tale of Genji because the Empress didn't have a new story and she wanted one.
Right.
And she's like, I'm so sick of these old stories I already heard 1,000 times. Tell me something new.
Right, right.
Also, Mishinaga had 13 kids, okay?
Oof.
He had 6 with each of his 2 wives, the sisters of those warrior clans.
Okay.
And 1 with an unknown woman.
Uh-oh.
So if I can pull into Speculation Station really quick.
Ooh.
What if Murasaki was the baby mama of this random kid?
Yeah, I mean, look, she's given him poems and stories. If not to your baby daddy, then who?
I'm not sure if I believe it myself because just her character doesn't bear out to me. Somebody who, A, would maybe have an affair like this.
Yeah.
Or B, wouldn't write about it, write it down somewhere.
Mm.
Because she did write down a lot of things that,
right.
Like some roasty type comments where you're like, oh, shit. I don't know.
And speaking of all these poems that, you know, she was giving to Mishinaga and just everything she was writing, she was in such high demand. Kind of want to hear some of that, right? So, hey, I got an idea.
Why don't we go on down to Poetry Corner and we'll hear what Murasaki has written for us.
As the song of the crickets fades in the hedge, it is impossible to stop autumn's farewell. How sad they must be too.
Wow, that is somber. Let's hear what else she's got tonight.
Westward messages following the moon. Why would I forget to send news along with the drifting clouds?
Yeah, it's lovely.
Evocative.
Yeah. You can see why she was in high demand.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when there was, like, again, no other entertainment.
Seriously.
I mean, if in 2021, all the internet went away, people would be thirsty for some Murasaki. They would be, would fight each other just to get their hands on a 3-line poem.
They'd be like, anyone just stand up in front of me and entertain me for 5 minutes or more.
Need content!
So now you've heard some of her poetry. We know that she's a popular author of this novel that's going around. So it might be that Mishinaga wanted Murasaki there to elevate Empress Shoshi's court. Because Emperor Ichijo's mother, Senshi, had a very well-respected literary salon of her own. So a lot like the French court of Madame Pompadour, if anyone remembers that episode from way back in the day.
Our very first episode.
Our very first. Noble women may have led some restricted lives, but they could wield considerable influence by holding powerful artistic salons like Madame Pompadour did. And so essentially they're creating pop culture in these salons. You know what I mean? They're deciding what other people need to be reading and talking about.
Right.
So common pastimes for noble women included having love affairs, writing poetry, and keeping diaries. Sounds great. And some of the writing done by noble women in the Heian period is recognized as some of the earliest and among the best Japanese literature. In fact, their writing has been called instrumental in creating a written Japanese language. So if it weren't for these women writing these stories in kana, you know what I mean? Like, they basically set the foundation for Japanese literature. They also adhered to rigid fashions of floor-length hair, whitened skin, and blackened teeth.
Blackened teeth.
Mm-hmm.
What a look.
I know.
It was like Halloween all the time.
I mean, how good were teeth in the year 1000 anyway?
That's fair. I'm just going to the, like, Japanese horror movie with, like, a girl with a white painted face, hair down to the floor, and blackened teeth, and
true.
I'm not going to sleep tonight. like, I've seen that movie too many times.
I mean, again, I think just everyone's teeth sucked and were, like, brown and yellow and broken. So
sure.
They were like, I mean, we can't make them whiter, so let's make them darker.
Just try and make it look like there's no teeth in
or
there.
Or maybe it was like, so, yeah, there's no teeth, so it's just this pink mouth. I mean, I don't know if anyone out there read Memoirs of a Geisha and loved it like I did when I was in high school and I was obsessed. But she talks a lot about how their fashion was very specific to make you think of vaginas.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
So their hairstyles would be like a peach shape or a rose shape with a pink ribbon in between.
Oh.
So you'd catch a little glimpse of pink or whatever. And it was just all that was supposed to be making men think about sex.
Because if there's one thing men need reminders of constantly,
I know, right?
It's vaginas.
I mean, come on.
Did you forget, sir? Let my hair remind you. Vagina. It's like, oh, I almost forgot about vaginas.
I forgot I was here to try and do it.
I also just caught myself sounding like Seth Rogen. I forgot about vaginas.
He definitely has said that before. Like, during Sausage Party, he was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I guess we'll just call it Sausage Party.
Forgot about vaginas.
Put that in the soundboard.
Yeah, right. I need a sound cue.
I
forgot about vaginas. Teishi also had literary salons. So you've got the emperor's mother, Senshi, who had very well-respected salons, and Teishi had one of her own going on. And she had another great writer named Sei Shonagon, who wrote The Pillow Book. And this was another highly regarded piece of Japanese literature. Unlike Genji, The Pillow Book wasn't fictional. It was actually a series of observational essays.
There was some, I think there was some poems in there, like some random observation. It was like a miscellaneous collection of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Blogs.
Blogs, yeah. The Medium posts of their time, yes. Yeah.
Now, Taishi herself died in childbirth, sadly, in 1001. So Murasaki and Shonagon, the two writers, they weren't here at court at the same time. So Mishinaga may have wanted a writer of similar stature as Shonagon to be a part of Shoshi's court, and Murasaki was already well known as a great writer, with chapters of Genji already kind of being distributed around the court, so that might be why he got her to come join Shoshi's court. He was like, oh, if Taishi had Shonagon, I gotta one-up that, mm-hmm. So I'm getting Murasaki. But officially, Murasaki was there as a companion tutor to teach Shoshi Chinese poetry. To teach Shoshi Chinese poetry. Say that 10 times fast.
To teach Shoshi Chinese poetry.
Don't actually say it 10 times. I'll just repeat it in post.
I won't, but it's
hard. The attitude towards Chinese as a language was contradictory, though, here. Sei Shonagon, who was the author in Taishi's salon, showed off her knowledge of Chinese. And Shoshi learned classical Chinese from Murasaki, but it was in secret. People didn't want to know she was learning Chinese. It was taboo, I guess. But she added screens with Chinese writing in her palace, and this caused an uproar because only men knew Chinese, so it's not supposed to be associated with women in any way.
Yeah.
How dare a woman put screens up with Chinese writing on them? We've never been so offended.
I guess it'd be like, you know how men used to be the only ones to curse? So right. Then if a woman put up a poster that said, fuck, you know, like all the dudes would be like, oh, my God.
My heart. Palpitations. But in either case, it was still becoming less popular to know Chinese anyway, since Japan was actively trying to assert its own language and culture at this point in history. So although Murasaki used the language in her writing and taught it to Shoshi, publicly, she rejected it. She was like, no, I'm not into that.
Yeah, she loved Chinese poets, and she mm-hmm. read a lot of Chinese literature, and, I mean, you know, it was a mark of education still.
Right.
And you had to know it if you're a man, even if you didn't want to, because that was the language of the government. You had to know. But, yeah, she was like, to be patriotic, I will say that Chinese is pretentious.
So, time for a little itty-bitty commercial break. We'll be right back.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star starting May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everyone. We are here, the Imperial Court. Not sure if Murasaki had a say in going to court or not. So I don't know if it was like a thing where you get invited, quote unquote, but it's like
you have to say
you don't get to say no.
Yeah.
Or if she really did have an opportunity to say, oh, thank you so much, but I'm good. I'll just stay at my dad's house. But if she did have a choice, it may have been that she felt like she needed a bit of a change. After her husband's death, she seemed to be pretty sad. So not sure if she was sad that he was dead, like because of himself, or if she just didn't like being a widow and felt kind of bored. She wrote, I felt depressed and confused. For some years, I had existed from day to day in a listless fashion, doing little more than registering the passage of time. The thought of my continuing loneliness was quite unbearable. So, yeah, she may have just been like, sure, change up my life. I'll go to the court. It'll be something different. But she seems to not have liked court life very much. She really disdained the writing of the other famed authors on the court, including Shonagon, although she was, like, reluctantly respectful. She's like, yeah, she's good, but she's too lighthearted. She felt everyone at the court was given to jealousy, drunkenness, and ennui. She wrote in her diary, I cannot be bothered to discuss matters in front of those women who continually carp and are so full of themselves. It would only cause trouble. So all they see of me is a facade. There are times when I am forced to sit with them, and on such occasions, I simply ignore their petty criticisms. Not because I am particularly shy, but because I consider it pointless. As a result, they now look upon me as a dullard.
That is so relatable. Like, that feels like high school so hard, or middle school, really, honestly, so hard to me.
Mm-hmm. I was like, I get this whole sentiment right here. You're just like, I'm not going to enter into any of your bullshit, and now everybody thinks you're no fun to hang out with.
Yeah, like, everyone's being the worst, so I'm just going to sit over here, which means they're going to look at me and be like, wow, that person's so boring, just sitting over there, just not saying anything. I'm like, well, what do you want me to say? Your bullshit is terrible.
Right.
I don't want to be a part of that.
Right. And if they're spending the whole time being like, you're so boring, what a dumb bitch. Like, right. What are you going to do? You'd be like, oh, yeah, let me argue
for the
with
invite.
You.
Yeah. I know,
right? Yeah, let me sit here and argue with you about whether or not I'm a dumb bitch.
Right.
Like, obviously, I'm not going to do that. Anyway, so
She knew that others in the court found her, quote, pretentious, awkward, difficult to approach, prickly, too fond of her tales, haughty, prone to versifying, disdainful, cantankerous, and scornful.
Wow.
That's so many bad adjectives in a row.
That is all of them.
But she also wrote once that people see her that way, and then if they ever take the time to know her, they're very surprised that she's kind and gentle. So I was like, maybe she just has a real aloof, I don't know, aspect. You know what I, like she has resting bitch face or something.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, she's probably really mean. And then if they actually give her, you know, some space to be herself, she's pretty cool. I don't know.
If you have that many negative adjectives about someone, you're bound to be overstating it. And you're going to be, that's like setting your bar so low for someone. And then they're like, hi. And you're like, wow. I thought you were going to literally stab me in the throat, but you actually said hello to me. I am very impressed.
Thomas Inge, who is an Asian literature scholar, believes that she, quote, had a forceful personality that seldom won her friends. So she's probably really opinionated and, again, just dismissive of all the stuff they were doing and liked to do. So,
yeah,
she's not super popular at court as a person. As a writer, yes. As a person, not so much.
Now, it's possible that she didn't hate court life as it was, but rather just found it boring to be a part of Shoshi's court.
Mm-hmm.
Snooze fest. Shoshi was a very serious person, and she judged people by very rigid standards. So her court, quote, gained a reputation for extreme dullness, as Murasaki wrote.
Not what Mishinaga was going for, by the way.
Yeah, right.
You know, he's over at the side like, damn it, we need to get some dancers in here or something.
To liven this up by introducing a poet.
Is there a comedy writer in the house? Anyone?
So apparently Shoshi gave her ladies-in-waiting some advice about not appearing too flirtatious, saying that going too far could lead to, quote, unpleasant consequences. So they should just reject men's advances, but not in such a way as to hurt their feelings. I'd be like, Jesus. What?
God, no.
You really gave me a narrow window to work in here, right?
I mean, this is a classic female problem here.
Yeah.
I just want you to know that. This is female trouble, 100%.
Be flirty, but not too flirty.
Not too flirty, and if you don't like them, you have to let them down easy because they might murder you.
Right. Oh, God. Murasaki wrote, quote, now that the Empress's exceedingly stylish brothers bring so many of their young courtier friends to amuse themselves at her house, we have, in self-defense, been obliged to become more virtuous than ever.
I think that's a good sign of a sense of humor in Murasaki,
That's snide
like,
and a little sarcastic, like, oh.
We're like into these guys, but no, we're going to put up our fans on our face and we're not even going to look at them. Shoshi wouldn't like it.
Yeah, but now that all these hot boys showed up, I guess we'll just be saintly virgins. Great choice, Shoshi. Thank you.
Or like, also like, thanks for your advice. Why are you bringing all these dudes around?
Right.
If you want me to let them down easy, don't let them in.
Bring some ugly dudes in here next time.
We'll
have a much easier
easy.
Time. Oh, thank you so much. I would love to, but I have to wash my floor-length hair tonight.
And it does take some time. It
takes 2 weeks. Three people. So, who knows? She may have liked court life better if she was serving Lady Senshi, the Emperor's mother. Her court was more lighthearted and fun.
Mm-hmm.
But hard to say, because it doesn't seem like Murasaki really approved of lighthearted kind of stuff that was going on up there. Like, she tended to look down on women who had affairs, for example, and she didn't like drunkenness, and she didn't enter, like, poetry competitions or anything like that.
Speculation Station.
Okay.
Did she teach Shoshi to be dull? Like, was she like, also, it's not classy to flirt with men? Do you know what I mean? Like, she had a little influence there.
But then she got sarcastic about it.
She did. So then I was like, maybe they were just kind of similar,
yeah,
in that respect, or she was just conforming.
Maybe.
I don't know. Or maybe she was like making fun of it. Like, this kid is so serious. What's going on?
You're seeing her as like a Daria type.
Mm.
Like, real, like, kind of flat and like, I'm not getting excited about things. No, I'm not going to engage in your spirited activities. But no, don't get drunk around me and have a party. And mm-hmm. also, don't be boring.
Yeah. Ugh.
Like, I think that's where I'm feeling about her right now. Is like, she's Daria.
She's Daria.
Yeah.
Right on. I think that works for me.
After Emperor Ishijo died in 1011, Shoshi left the court along with Murasaki, and they lived in a Fujiwara mansion. And Murasaki may have died in the year 1014, though some believe she died maybe in 1025, quite a bit later. But she dedicated her days to literature and religion, and her daughter, Kenshi, became a distinguished poet in her own right.
And the tale of Genji, meanwhile, has never gone out of style. Helen McCullough, an American translator and Japanologist, says it has universal appeal because, quote, its basic subject matter and setting are those of the romance. Murasaki Shikibu's unique genius has made the work for many a powerful statement of human relationships, the impossibility of permanent happiness in love, and the vital importance, in a world of sorrows, of sensitivity to the feelings of others. Japan has not seen another such genius.
Wow, that is both very complimentary to this work and very insulting to every author of Japan ever since then. Right?
Listen, I've got a great teacher Onizuka manga that would say different, ma'am. The story was so popular that Emperor Ichijo had it read to him, even though it was in Japanese and not Chinese.
Oh, wow.
And it was highly sought after in provinces where copies were scarce, of course, because they weren't close to the court to get them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gimme. Are you done with that yet? I want to read it.
Do you know they probably read them out of order and stuff, too? Like, whenever they got a chapter, they were just like, fuck it.
Yeah.
Can you read it?
Yeah.
As early as the 12th century, her writing was considered required reading for court poets and was studied by scholars.
Wow.
So it didn't take very long before
they jumped right on it.
They were like, this is good.
Yeah. In the 17th century, female virtue became tied to literary knowledge, right? Ladies, learning. We love it. And suddenly Murasaki or Genji-inspired stuff was in high demand. 1600s, this stuff was popping off.
Mm-hmm.
Lacquer boxes, you had screens with the images painted on them, scrolls, and so on. They all depicted scenes from Genji or illustrations of Murasaki. These all became very popular for noble women, and they symbolically imbued a bride with more cultural status. So they became like great wedding gifts and stuff. In the 18th century, these items had come to symbolize marital success. So everyone was like, get your Genji lunch boxes, get your Genji Letterman jackets, get your Genji phone cases, socks. Yeah.
We got shirts with Murasaki on us. She's looking at the moon.
You can wrap your car in chapter 8 of The Tale of Genji.
Yeah, you could make one of those bags that's got all the words from the story.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Those tote bags.
That would be a big bag.
It would.
For a 1,000-page.
Oof.
In 2008, Kyoto held a year-long celebration of the 1,000th year of The Tale of Genji. That's what that New York Times article is about. The author is at that celebration, kind of describing it. And they held poetry competitions, and women would dress up in the court dress of the high-end period. So they were wearing floor-length wigs. They were on those sandals that they would wear that just had like basically two little boards you were walking on.
Yeah.
And they had these really elaborate dresses and everything.
Did they blacken their teeth?
Maybe not.
Chew on some charcoal.
Maybe not.
For a while.
Maybe they didn't do it all. They might have left that part out. Since the epic is so long, as we've pointed out, very few people read the actual thing anymore in Japan, I should say. But they consume racy mangas and abridged editions that are sometimes very bawdy.
Oh.
And they're written in modern Japanese. New York Times says that inventors at Kyoto University have even produced a Murasaki robot that recites passages of her work.
Sure. Well, I mean, we need a robot for everything. This one just reads passages from The Tale of Genji.
Well, it's kind of like how we had Wishbone Classics. You know what I mean?
You're
I know kids are not going to read the Odyssey, but follow this beagle through the Odyssey. But yeah, you know, they just want to engage you with this classic work in any way they can, basically.
Right.
And I'm curious. I'm not going to lie. I would read a racy manga. So yeah, that's the story of Murasaki Shikibu and The Tale of Genji.
Yeah, I think this is so cool to like kind of take a different view of of romance, you know, again, not through a couple, but rather through like a whole cultural movement and a work of literature that really, you know, not even changed the game, but just was definitive. You know, it grew into something else. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And I just got really fascinated that somebody who experienced so little romance in her own life was so great about writing about it that everyone's still talking about it 1,000 years later. Yeah. And she's a symbol for marital happiness.
Yeah.
Like, that's just funny to me that I feel like if she could see her the effect today, she'd be like, oh, for real? All right. Cool.
She'd take a creative writing course today and the first thing they'd say is, first lesson is write what you know. And she'd be like, fuck you. I'm going to write what I think and it's going to be brilliant.
That's right.
It's going to endure. But you got to be that smart to do that.
Very true. And she actually had something interesting to say with her observations, as did, say, Shonagon.
Right.
Without the pillow book, we also wouldn't know very much about high-end court life and what it was like. So because of their writing, you know, really gave us a peek into an ancient culture. So this was cool. I hope you guys enjoyed this one.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. This is a really fun one. And it's, like you said, so great to kind of peek back at ancient feudal Japan, kind of learn something there. Such a cool culture. Just stylistically from the outside looking in, I think I love that era. Well, definitely let us know what you all thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to reach us. Our email address is romance@iheartmedia.com.
And we're on social media. I'm at Diana Might Boom on Instagram and Twitter.
And I am at Oh Great, It's Eli.
And the show is at Ridic Romance.
And don't forget, if you want to jump onto Apple Podcasts, they are like the only place you can leave an actual review of the show. And we love them. We love getting them and we love hearing from you guys. And we love seeing your kind, awesome words. And they help the show get out to more people. So don't forget to go check us out on Ridiculous History.
Yes.
Two-parter there with Diana and I both popping in to say hi to Ben and Noel. We had a great time joining them.
And a lot of you have said you want a Speculation Station t-shirt, so we will try to get the ball rolling on that.
We're working
now
on
that
it.
We've sold, what, 10?
10 or 11, yeah.
That's something.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to take it to the corporate overlords and say, look how much money you could be making off of us.
At least $50.
Look, hey, sorry to break the news for you, but those shirts ain't going to be $5.
Nope.
They're going to make us pay for them.
True. Well, anyway, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Thanks again, y'all. We will talk to you soon.
Love you. Bye.
So long, friends. It's time to go. Thanks for listening to our show. Tell your friends, neighbors, uncles, and aunts to listen to our show, Ridiculous Romance.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast.
Binge close to 100 episodes.
Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with the season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.